the week, definitely during the Monday.
So, Anthony, we're pleased to have Charlie Torrey from Utah State, who's going to talk on symmetry, radiation, gravitational theories, and the Utah Jazz.
Prefer not to talk about the latter topic right now. This is some work that's in progress in collaboration with Ian Anderson and Mark Fells. And I apologize a little bit that there are a lot of half-baked results here, but the idea, of course, is that with such a large assembly of experts, I might be able to get some feedback on some of these issues, because some of the ideas are quite old that we're playing with. It's fine. When I give a talk on this topic, usually I have to spend some time motivating a bit why you want to use symmetry methods in field theory and so forth. But in general relativity, we don't really need too much motivation, since we use symmetry methods either explicitly or implicitly quite often. And I'll just remind you that some of the places where symmetry reduction ideas are coming into play, where you're imposing some symmetries on your gravitational field and seeing what you get out. Of course, in exact solutions of the Einstein equations, most of them have been found using symmetry methods. One oftentimes builds models using symmetry methods. So I'm thinking things like mini superspace and midi superspace models, where you impose some symmetries on your space-time, and you consider the resulting reduced system of field equations, perhaps as a Hamiltonian system. You can study classical and quantum dynamical issues in these models and learn a lot about the theory there. More generally, this idea of symmetry reduction has to do with dimensional reduction. So if you're building field theories that maybe are existing in higher dimensions and you have many different kinds of matter, perhaps, or maybe just a pure gravitational field, a lot of times in order to make contact with the four-dimensional macroscopic world, one will impose some symmetries on the theory in order to affect some kind of a dimensional reduction. And the classic example of this is the Kaluza-Klein reduction that everybody knows about. So these sorts of things involve symmetry, gravitational fields usually, in a fairly strong way. And it's kind of surprising, if you look at the sort of mathematical literature on symmetry reduction of field differential equations and so forth, it's kind of surprising that the theory is quite well developed and has been around for quite a long time. It's, you find it in many textbooks of how you systematically reduce some field theory, if you will, using some symmetries, but very little of this theory is used, at least explicitly, when studying reductions in general relativity and other gravitational theories. So let me just sort of try to explain why I think that is so, and by way of introduction and sort of motivation and history. And the basic idea of symmetry reduction goes all the way back to Lee, as far as I can tell, and Lee, of course, was originally studying transformation groups that map solutions of differential equations to other solutions, and this is, I believe, how the whole idea of Lie groups started. Was he was considering transformations of differential equations, and along the way, so he considered a very basic phenomenon that we all know about, which maybe I should at least make explicit here for the purposes of our discussion. Namely, you start off with some n-dimensional manifold, and you have some differential equations, some Lagrangians, and so forth. You have your field theory sitting up here. You consider a transformation group on the manifold. Maybe it'll have q-dimensional orbits, so you have a transformation group, and you then can look at a space of orbits, which will be, well, basically q-dimensional, under favorable circumstances, will be a lower dimension by the orbit dimension. And you can somehow aspire to take your theory up here, which may be very complicated and very difficult, reduce it down to here, and get something that's perhaps a little more tractable. And this is a standard method for finding solutions of nonlinear differential equations. Now, what one of Lee's main observations was that this whole procedure works quite nicely, provided you choose the symmetry group that you're going to use to reduce by or with. You choose the symmetry group to be a subgroup of the symmetry group of the theory, or the symmetry group of the differential equations. So, for example, in the Einstein theory or other generally covariant gravitational theories, the symmetry group is at least as big as the diffeomorphism group of space-time. So you have an enormous group that you can play with and consider symmetries as coming from subgroups of that group, which I'll talk about again in a moment. In any case, this was Lee's main observation, among other things. And however, for some reason, which I still haven't quite figured out historically, but early on in this game, and I guess it's because of the type of applications that applied mathematicians are usually looking at, there was a certain transversality assumption being made on the symmetry groups that were being used. Roughly speaking, the group action that you're using to model the symmetry was acting always transversally on the space of field. And what this means, without getting technical, and the whole, I try to avoid technicalities wherever I can in this talk, the idea is that a transversal symmetry doesn't reduce the number of field quantities. So, for example, consider homogeneous cosmologies, where you have a three-dimensional Lie group acting transitively on space-like hypersurfaces. And that's what you call your symmetry group, and you can now consider metrics that have this homogeneous character. And you start off in four dimensions with 10 functions of four variables. These are the metric components of some chart. You impose homogeneity, and you end up with 10 functions of one variable, which is labeling the hypersurfaces of homogeneity. Right? So you end up with actually a system of ODEs when you reduce the Einstein equations this way. So no big deal. That's a transversal symmetry reduction in which the number of field variables hasn't changed. You started with 10, you end with 10. On the other hand, if you take a very simple symmetry that we use all the time in field theory, namely spherical symmetry, and you impose spherical symmetry on a metric, then you know that the result is that you end up not with 10 functions of two variables, but with four functions of two variables characterizing these spherically symmetric metrics. So you've lost some field degrees of freedom, as it were. And the point is that that sort of symmetry reduction was just not allowed by some of the technical assumptions that are made in the general theory. So while you have whole textbooks written on Lie symmetry theory and reduction by groups of differential equations, most of the first assumptions they make rule out things like spherical symmetry, and so we don't find these sorts of reduction methods quite so useful in field theory. In fact, you can find in textbooks statements to the effect that equations like the Euler equations for fluid flow or the Maxwell equations don't admit spherically symmetric solutions. So, and this is an eye-opener when you're reading these books. And of course, what they really mean is that you can't get at those solutions using these Lie methods with this transversality assumption that's sort of built in. And it's not so hard to drop it. Not so hard to drop the assumption, but then you sort of have to uniformly rewrite everything that's known. And that's sort of what we're trying to do. And it turns out that the key role in all this is always going to be played by the notion of isotropy in the group, in the symmetry, and that's something that will flavor the whole talk.
Okay.
Yes, yes. So this is just sort of historical comments. So let me tell you exactly what we're going to do.
Did it not bother the people that they couldn't find solutions or did they pay attention?
I guess it's the applied mathematicians, at least that I know, is sort of the Peter Oliver school of symmetry reduction and so forth, don't seem to be looking at the kind of relativistic field theories that we all think about all the time. And they're looking at KdV equations and there's scalar differential equations, and they just don't need to know about this non-transversal sort of reduction. So yeah, I think they are a little bothered, and it took us a long time of arguing before we finally convinced them that they were making a very strong assumption. In fact, I think we had at some point just write down the spherically symmetric solution and say, here it is. It's funny how it goes. But so the idea is to sort of survey some ideas without, and hopefully avoid too many technicalities, because this is a very old subject in a lot of ways, as I said, 100 years or so. And there's a lot of things that are known and a lot of things that aren't known and a lot of things that I hope I know that maybe are a little bit new, but probably there are a lot of things that I think I know but aren't new. So in any case, the first part is sort of a kinematical discussion, and I want to talk about just a little bit about group actions on manifolds, just to sort of define terminology, things like isotropy and so forth. And then we're not interested in gravitational theories and just any old group actions. We're interested in group actions that are in some sense symmetries of a metric, so we want to specialize quickly to isometries, say a little bit about some just basic things there, basically again to introduce terminology. Say a few words about classification of isometries, which is kind of amusing that you can even talk about such things. And then the first sort of main kinematical result is to think about what happens when you impose a symmetry on a metric. What can you say about the metrics that admit a given symmetry group? What kind of structure do they have in general? What do you know up front? And so this is the first example of taking some structure, like a metric, up on the starting field theory, imposing a symmetry, and then seeing what the structure looks like, if at all, if you can even reduce it down to the space of orbits of the group, and seeing what these structures look like downstairs in the reduced space. And this is the sort of thing I'm actually kind of interested in for the rest of the talk, almost. More dynamical sort of issues are, what happens when you have a Lagrangian, or maybe a conservation law in your theory? How does it behave when you impose a symmetry? In what sense can you think of these structures as reducing down to give you some Lagrangians and conservation laws in the reduced theory? And that's, there are lots of other issues one could look at, lots of other structures one can try and study the reduction of, but these are two that I think are particularly interesting, so, and easily explained. Focus on these. Then, in case that gets a little bit too dry, I stuck one more topic on the end here if we have time, and that is something I'll call universal symmetry, sort of cryptically, and it's just sort of a curiosity that appears in when you think about imposing symmetries on a field theory, and I'll try to just briefly describe that when we get to the end. Local solutions, not solving any field equations per se. I want to sort of talk about, think about these things quite generally, and make comments that are valid for any set of field equations, basically, or any Lagrangian or any conservation laws. Try to have very general statements so that if somebody adds in an extra matter field or tweaks the symmetry group a little bit, the results are robust and you can use them in any case. So at the moment, we're not talking so much about solutions as we are for reduction of structures that appear in gravitational theories. And I'll try to make that more clear as we go. So the idea is we're going to impose some symmetry on a field theory, say Einstein's theory or some other variation of it, and we're going to model the symmetry in terms of a group act, transformation group acting on the manifold. So basically one has some, I'll always have a finite dimensional Lie group acting by diffeomorphisms on the manifold in the usual way. And if that doesn't seem too familiar, I'm sure it does, but if, in case it doesn't, you can also think about infinitesimal transformations in terms of vector fields generating infinitesimal transformations on the manifold. Now, there are a couple of things we need to just define up front, because they'll feature quite a lot in some of the applications. The first thing we need to define is the isotropy group of a point, or a stabilizer group, which is, everybody, I think everybody knows what this is, but just to be clear, we'll think of this as a subgroup of your transformation group, which fixes that point that you've chosen, we'll call it X. Okay? So you look, you have some group of transformations of a manifold, you can look, pick a point, see what group fixes, subgroup, if any, fixes that point, and we'll call that the isotropy group. Okay? Now, associated with an isotropy group, there's also this so-called linear isotropy group, which arises from the fact that you've got this diffeomorphism, which is an element of your group, or corresponding to an element of your group. It fixes the point. The point doesn't move, but of course the induced action on the tangent space of that point may very well be non-trivial. So the point doesn't go anywhere, but vectors of that point may get transformed, for example, under the action of this group. And so one has at each point a so-called linear isotropy group, which is just the induced action on the tangent space of that point due to this isotropy element. You can also think of it quite profitably as a representation of the isotropy group on the tangent space of the manifold at that point. These are really the only structures we'll need to, for the most part, to talk about. Now, just to sort of cover my backside, I'll make a blanket assumption right up front in order to avoid talking about certain subtleties, which I'm not interested in anyway, at least for the purposes of this talk. So this is sort of a way of saying what I don't want to, or what I'm not going to be talking about today. Is right up front, I'm going to assume you have this manifold, this is your space-time manifold, you have some symmetry group that you want to use to make a symmetry reduction of your field theory, and this space here is the space of orbits, okay? And I'm just going to assume flat out the action is regular, so that this is a manifold, okay? As is well known, this is far from guaranteed for any, not even for reasonable group actions, but I'm going to assume it up front because the idea is to build the field theory down here and talk about its properties, and I don't want to have to worry about what's happening at conical singularities and non-Hausdorff points and so forth. So smooth manifold without boundary is the assumption. There are a number of implications of this, but let me, yeah?
What got in mind is that there might be singular points, but you don't care
typically you can remove points up here and just remove some points here, and then the space of orbits will be a manifold, so typically.
Typically with fixed points or something up on top, which causes the problem.
That's one way you can get into trouble.
So
there are other ways.
Do you need fixed points? You're just talking about that.
No, so fixed points will be points that are fixed by all, the whole group. The isotropy group is just a subgroup. Yeah. Right, so fixed points we don't want. We don't want orbits passing too close to themselves and things like that in order to make this a manifold. It's a restriction, and one can then begin trying to release this restriction. But, well, I think there's enough interesting things to talk about today without worrying about that. But, and it almost seems like one has to some extent treat some of this stuff on a case-by-case basis then, and one can't make so many general results. And I should say, as I was saying to Abai, the philosophy of the game is to try to have very general results which are very robust and aren't pinned too much to any specific field theory. So we're thinking of theories of gravity, and I'll be giving you results relevant to fit theories of gravity, but without perhaps saying exactly which theory of gravity I'm talking about and what dimension I'm in and so forth. Okay, so the only thing I'll mention here is when you assume that this space here is a manifold, among other things, that implies that the orbits up here of the group have fixed dimension, q. Okay, and we'll always call, so whenever you see a q, that's an orbit dimension. And there's only one orbit dimension. Okay, so as I mentioned, in if you even going back to Lee noticed that if you want to reduce a theory from a starting space down to a smaller space by using a symmetry group, the idea is you should choose your group to be a subgroup of the symmetry group of the theory. And as I said, that leaves you an enormous number of possibilities a priori in a gravitational theory where you have this at least general covariance in the theory to work with. And that is to say you have the whole diffeomorphism group. So the thing that, of course, cuts everything down to size is that almost all the subgroups of the diffeomorphism group fail to preserve a metric. And of the appropriate, well, of any kind, really. So we need to assume, of course, that we're considering a group of isometries. And what this means is that we want to have the group action, remember, which is labeled by called alpha, should preserve some metric with the appropriate signature. And for now, I mean, later I'll specialize to some extent of Lorentzian signature, but for now we'll just let the signature be generic since I don't need to make any restrictions yet. Now you might say, well, this is trivial. Everybody knows this is what an isometry is. But the game we're playing is a little different. Usually you're handed a metric, and now you're asked to find the isometries of the metric. Here I want to hand you the group action and ask what metrics are invariant under this action. So I'm sort of running the game backwards. Because the idea, of course, is to fix your symmetry and then find what fields are compatible with that symmetry. So infinitesimally, this means then that you're going to have some Lie algebra vector fields floating around such that if you take the Lie derivative of the metric with respect to these vector fields, you should get zero. And so we'll always assume that such metrics exist with these properties. Yeah.
Are you putting yourself in gravitational constant?
Is this sitting there and then in the field? No, I kind of want to consider, so I have a manifold. I have a group of a finite dimensional group of diffeomorphisms acting on the manifold, and I'm asking for what is a if I have a metric which is invariant under that group, what's it look like? And what I'm pointing out in some sense is that there may be no metric invariant under that group. You just have to, and I'm assuming that there will be one. Otherwise, I'm not interested in the group. Does that help at all?
But you've been talking about a field theory of this manifold.
Yes.
Right. Is a field theory folded metric or a field
theory
for another field?
At this point, I'm interested in thinking of a field theory of a metric.
Of a metric, yeah. Okay.
That's going to be the main context. Okay. But so we're thinking about symmetry reduction in the context of gravitational theories built from a metric. By the way, most of everything I say here has some kind of a generalization to other kinds of field theories. So you can change. You can have spinners and connections or harmonic maps or what have you. But the for obvious reasons, we'll think about metrics today.
And are you always assuming your Q is greater than zero?
No. No, I guess not. I guess we could have purely just discrete groups.
But then you wouldn't have your
cutting. Right. So this is assuming there is any infinitesimal, assuming the group is actually has finite dimension or non-zero dimension. Right. Right. Absolutely. So if you assume that there exists, you have a transformation group, and that there are indeed metrics which are invariant under it, so you can talk about symmetry reduction of a metric theory, then there are a couple of consequences that should be pointed out. First of all, there's the fact that this isotropy group, this is the subgroup that fixes this point X, is as an abstract group isomorphic to the linear isotropy group, which remember was the group that acts on the tangent space at that point. So these two are isomorphic as Lie groups. And moreover, The linear isotropy group can always be identified with a subgroup of the appropriate orthogonal group for the signature that you're working in, say the Lorentz group then in four dimensions. And the point of this is quite simple. You have a group of subgroup of transformations which fixes a point. It induces an action on the tangent space at that point. You have a metric at that point which is invariant under that action, which doesn't change, move the point around at all. So all it can do is preserve the quadratic form you have at that point. So you have some linear set of linear transformations preserving a quadratic form of a certain signature at that point. So it has to be some subgroup of the orthogonal group. This actually causes some confusion in the literature from the point of view of a lot of times these two groups being isomorphic are sort of identified. And this one, of course, is acting, you should always remember, acting as a group of transformations on the manifold. This one is acting on the tangent space at a point. So as groups, they can be identified, but certainly not as mappings or transformations. Okay. So that's sort of a lightning review of some terminology and elementary results about group actions that have invariant metrics, because we're trying to think about symmetry reduction of field theories built from metrics. Now, I'll talk a little bit about classification type issues. So you might ask, how many possible symmetries can you write down for a space-time of Lorentz signature? And this restriction I just showed you, that the linear isotropy group has to be a subgroup of the orthogonal group, cuts way down to size the number of symmetries that a space-time can admit. And I just mentioned in passing here that Petrov has actually, in some sense, and co-workers a long time ago, classified all these symmetry groups. So in some sense, you can count all the symmetries a gravitational field might admit. And Petrov works in four dimensions. He looks really at infinitesimal symmetry, so he's looking at algebras of killing vector fields. He's assuming that everything is analytic, and Lorentz signature. And in particular, he assumes that the orbit types of the symmetries are fixed. That is to say, when you look at the orbits of the local group of transformations that these killing vectors generate, they're always either space-like, time-like, or null. Makes this little regularizing assumption, which allows you to actually start finding how many groups there are. And he finds approximately, depending on how you count, like 60 different groups. So if you want to ask how many possible symmetries can a gravitational field ever have, well, the answer is there's sort of 60 distinct... It's a sort of surprising thing to find that you can actually do it. It's quite a tour de force. And it's just a brute force, typical calculation where you just sit there and churn and churn and churn and solve, keep finding the metrics that admit certain algebras of killing vector fields. And it's quite a long process.
Can you repeat?
Yeah. So the idea is that you have orbits of a certain dimension, and they're always the same dimension. Okay. So, and you're assuming that they're either, you're looking for symmetries that admit invariant metrics and such that these orbits are always either space-like, time-like, or null, but never mixing among themselves. So all orbits are space-like, for example. So an example would be the rotational symmetry. All orbits of...
The Lorentz group,
well, in that sense you would say, in that sort of game you would probably say that the orbits are all time-like, because the Lorentz group is... Well, I'm thinking of the Poincaré group, because, of course, you have the whole manifold. The Lorentz group acting on... Right, so you could only sort of see bits and pieces of some groups. For a good example is if you look at the Kruskal extension of Schwarzschild, the maximally extended Schwarzschild black hole space-time. There will be space-like orbits, time-like orbits, and null orbits killing vector fields there. Outside the hole, you have time-like orbits. On the horizon, you have null orbits. And inside, you have space-like orbits. So in this sort of game, he would sort of break those up into three different pieces and consider them separately. Okay, so for what it's worth, in some sense, you can enumerate all possible symmetries. So when we're talking about symmetries of a gravitational field, at least with these sorts of assumptions, you kind of know, you can go and look up in Petrov what they are, if you'd like. Not to do any... It's true, but he's always working locally. And so he's always thinking in the neighborhood of a point, I can always assume the orbits have this character. And it may be that if you go try to make that neighborhood too big, this assumption breaks down, and then you might have to patch these things together. It's true. In general, you may have much more complicated global structure than what he was assuming. But here, everything is very local. In fact... Not to do any injustice to Petrov, but most of this, while this is sort of a, if you try to ever read any of this stuff, it's just sort of a exhilarating mess. And most of these, almost all the space-times with symmetry that you can write down, that is to say four-dimensional Lorentzian manifold that emit some the algebra of killing vector fields, are all what we call local simple G spaces. And all that, this is just a name that characterizes the following situation. In the small, all that ever happens in these, in almost all these spacetimes of symmetry, is that you're thinking of the space-time manifold as a product of the space of orbits, which is just invariant under this transformation, and a homogeneous space. Okay? And these locally, the infinitesimal symmetry group is acting here only, and leaving this part alone. That's the idea. Okay? So it's no big deal. I mean, this is how you might always try, if you wanted to build a manifold of an appropriate dimension by with a certain group action, this is might be what you do, right? You take some space that you're just going to let be inert under the group action. You take a product of that space with your favorite homogeneous space where you know exactly how the group acts, and you just say, this is my space-time, at least locally. And this is almost all these symmetry groups are like that. In order to talk about reduction of metrics in a moment, I'll need to give you a global model of that. But let me just mention a result which is probably well known, but which is hard to find in the literature. It's not too hard to show that this assumption of time-like or space-like orbits, or an assumption of no isotropy whatsoever, the isotropy group at each point is trivial, is enough to give you this local simple G structure. Okay. So once you know that the orbits are time-like or space-like, or that there is no isotropy, then this product structure, at least locally, is occurring. So you know a lot about, at least locally, what the group actions are doing up front, just sort of an assumption. And we'll worry about the proof. Now, the simple G structure, which is almost always what happens for space-times with symmetry, has a nice global version, which I just want to mention because I want to use some of this ideas when I talk about invariant metrics in detail. And the picture is that the space-time is a fiber bundle over some space of orbits, with fibers being this homogeneous space. And what I just told you was sort of a local version of this same structure. Okay? And there are lots of features of this global picture. This is sort of a global model of what we call the simple G space. But in particular, the key feature I think I'll mention is here, that when you have this sort of fiber bundle structure, all the isotropy groups at each point in M are related by conjugation in the symmetry group. So you just have one conjugacy class of isotropy here in this case. I'll also mention, I guess, as long as we're here, that if you think of this as a bundle, as we are, then there's a structure group floating around, and the structure group is obtained by taking the normalizer of the isotropy group in the group G mod the isotropy group itself. And this is just some technical feature, the normalizer being the largest subgroup of the G group for which H is a normal subgroup. Okay, so what's the point of all this? Let me just mention that if you don't have this sort of simple G structure, then the only possible time when that happens is when you have null orbits plus some isotropy group. So, for example, plane wave spacetimes don't fall into this class of simple G spaces. That is to say, this large majority of the symmetries that you can impose on a metric are not type-bound when you look, for example, at plane wave spacetimes. I'll say a little bit more about plane waves in a minute. And there are various other regularity assumptions you can prove about these metrics. Let me...
No, plus.
So if you have no isotropy, you always have these simple G spaces. If I had this comment that I said very quickly that the isotropy groups are always conjugate in these simple G spaces. But if the isotropy group is the identity, then they're always sitting in there. They're always conjugate, trivially. And so, in fact, you always have these simple G spaces. So what you need to make this non-simple G effect occur is null orbits and isotropy, both. All right, so let me just say a couple words about reduction of structures at the kinematic level. So we'll talk about what happens when you impose a symmetry on a metric. Okay. And I'm going to make the assumption that we have one of these simple G spaces and a non-degenerate metric on the orbits. Okay, so space-like or time-like orbits only. And that's the only case where I can really give you a clean geometric characterization of these invariant metrics. So the game is you're in some starting space, four dimensions or higher if you like. You impose some symmetry group G. You now construct the theory down on the reduced space, the space of orbits, and you want to know what does the metric look like. And this is, of course, the familiar Kaluza-Klein kind of construction, but this is, I think, maybe one of the most general statement that you can make. So quite generally, what you'll always have is that these metrics invariant under the symmetry group G will be built in a one-to-one fashion from the following three pieces of data, which are familiar, of course, to particle physicists, but I don't know how general these Kaluza Klein reductions have been studied in the particle physics literature. You, of course, get a metric on the space of orbits. This is your reduced gravitational field. You have a family of invariant metrics on this homogeneous space fiber, okay, where by family, I mean you have a metric for each point in the reduced space. So these are the Kaluza-Klein scalar field, transforming according to this some subgroup of this group G. And you also, of course, have a gauge field. As I say, you have a connection on some bundle. So you have this gauge field, and I won't say much about how you construct it unless you're interested, but I will mention that the gauge group that you get is always obtained by taking this normalizer group, the structure group for that simple G space, the normalizer of the isotropy group inside the full group, quotienting out by the isotropy group. And this will tell you essentially how many gauge fields you have. Okay, and this group will act here. Now this result is, I just found out recently, this result is also in some form sitting inside some papers of Kokoro and Jadzik from the 80s. Nice papers too. But I think there's a slight generalization here in that they're always assuming that groups are compact. And you can actually release or relax that assumption provided that the orbits are have non-degenerate metrics induced on them. So this is, I guess, maybe the nicest geometrical interpretation you can have. And everybody in examples knows that this sort of structure appears. Whenever you do your favorite symmetry reduction to build your favorite model, you always see some of this structure appearing. And I'm just telling you that quite generally, this is the structure you'll get. And you should always, you can, with a little bit of thought, you can sort of always predict what you'll get by playing with these sorts of structures. The one thing that would be nice to know is what is a good geometrical interpretation for invariant metrics when the group action has null orbits? And this is maybe something that's known out there, but I haven't seen it. So I'd be curious if anybody had any pointers there. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yashik, huh? Okay.
So they raise this issue if we can have something more, if we can have something more interesting if we release this,
this is the isotropy here.
And the question was if there is isotropy group, we can find some new kind of field.
Yes.
And the result is that actually we cannot. We have this Young-Mills, maybe a little.
I'm not sure what you mean.
More general.
That's not the way I understand the paper. I mean, the way I was understanding the paper is, I mean, one of the nice things they did, in fact, was to generalize this Yang-Mills construction, which usually is done where you think of space-time as a principal bundle, and instead thought of space-time as a bundle with fibers G over H. So the H here is the isotropy group of the group action. So I would have thought that their first observation was that one can look at these Kaluza-Klein reduction with homogeneous spaces instead of just with groups as your fibers. Now, they may have asked for even further generalizations, which I'm not aware of. So maybe you're thinking about subsequent papers or some other papers. Because, I mean, adding in the isotropy...
Then the result was negative.
It changes the size of the gauge group, basically. And it changes to some extent the Kaluza-Klein scalar field, how many there are and how they transform under the gauge group. But... So I'm not sure what you mean when you say they have a negative result, but maybe we can sort that out. Okay. Now I want to talk about reductions in some other structures, and hopefully this maybe will be a little more amusing than some of this background material. So I want to talk about reduction of Lagrangians. So here's the game I want to play, and probably most of you have played this game, and I know certainly Mike Ryan has thought a lot about this, for example. And the game is as follows. You have some field theory built out of a metric, Einstein's theory, if you like. You have some Lagrangian for the theory. And you would like to know whether or not, when you make this symmetry reduction, you restrict attention to fields with a certain symmetry, and you have some reduced field theory down here on the space of orbits, you'd like to know whether this Lagrangian, in any nice way, induces a Lagrangian downstairs on the space of orbits. In fact, a game we play all the time in field theory is we take a assumption of symmetry, we put that symmetry into the Lagrangian, and now we have our reduced Lagrangian, we use it to compute our reduced field equations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, you can ask about two possible ways you can get your reduced theory. You can take your Lagrangian, you can form some field equations, the Euler Lagrange equations. Or, and then you can take these field equations and you can impose your symmetry and get some reduced field equations for your reduced sets of fields, such as these gauge fields, scalar fields, and reduced fields, and so forth. Okay. Now, the shortcut that people like to take is you can take the starting Lagrangian, you impose the symmetry on the fields in the Lagrangian, then form the field equations. And the natural question is whether or not this sort of diagram commutes, and you can see that I've been working with math types too long because everything ends up being a commutative diagram. But one can ask this question whether this process is commutative, and the answer is not in general. And I don't know... definitely not. So I shouldn't... I sort of presuppose that it might be. But this is the hope, usually, that this diagram commutes. And it won't in general. I don't know who first noticed this in sort of variational calculus, but certainly one of the earlier citations I've seen on this sort of issue in general relativity is de Hawking in the late 60s looking at these homogeneous cosmologies. In fact, this phenomenon where this diagram doesn't commute is very well known in homogeneous cosmology to workers in that area. Which we'll talk about a little bit more in a minute. But in fact, this is how I got interested in this whole symmetry reduction game. I had these math types where I work. We're talking about symmetry reductions of variational principles. I said, hey, I got a good example for you. And we ran the Bianchi B through their little machine of analyzing this question. And they said, yes, indeed, Bianchi B is not going to work. And I said, well, I knew that already, but thanks. And then I asked them, okay, let's try some other symmetries like spherical symmetry, and then this transversality assumption kicked in and the whole thing crashed. And we had to reboot the theory a little bit. But the main question then, as you might ask, given, say, this Bianchi class B phenomenon that people are pretty aware of, is when is it okay to reduce a Lagrangian by a symmetry? You might think that you have to tell me what the theory is, you have to tell me what the symmetry group is, you have to give me the Lagrangian, you have to check it. And that would be an unfortunate state of affairs, and if that were the case, I wouldn't be telling you anything. But in fact, one can give quite general criteria upon which this Lagrangian reduction will work. So one can know up front, without knowing anything really about the Lagrangian at all, whether or not you can perform this reduction at the level of the Lagrangian. So the interesting thing that happens is that the ability to reduce a Lagrangian like this is really tied into the nature of the symmetry group and not so much tied into the nature of the Lagrangian. And I'm obligated to point out that this issue has been investigated quite a bit by Richard Pillay. He called this commutivity, if it exists up here, the principle of symmetric criticality. And he, of course, approaches it from a quite different sort of functional analytic direction. But I've heard of this consistent truncations and consistent compactifications, and it's a very general issue that you can bump up into whenever you're running into symmetry reductions. And it's kind of nice to once and for all just figure out when it works and when it doesn't, so you don't have to keep checking it every time. And so that we can do, and that's what I want to describe to you. First, maybe I'll tell you what goes wrong. So there are two obstructions to this reduction of Lagrangians working. The first, and to talk about it, let me just remind you that the variation of a Lagrangian is always given by some volume term, which has the field equations in it, and some surface term, or total divergence, or exact form, however you like to think about it. I'll just call this the boundary term. Okay? And basically, these two terms have their own difficulties when you try to impose a symmetry on the theory. So you're trying to carry this formula down for your reduced Lagrangian, and you hope that the field equations you get in the reduced theory are the correct ones. And two things can go wrong. We could look at a lot of examples in detail, but it would take too much time. So let me just tell you that there are two kinds of things that can go wrong. First thing is that these boundary terms may not reduce properly. The boundary term up here may not become a boundary term on the reduced theory. Then what happens is then this thing becomes a boundary term on the reduced theory plus some extra terms, which feed into the Euler Lagrange equations and give you the wrong equations. And this is exactly what's happening in Bianchi B. Cosmologies. Okay, so one possibility is the boundary terms go bad and you get the wrong field equations. Even if the boundary terms go right, you can still get problems because of the volume terms, which I've sort of erased here, which is where the field equations sit. It may happen that when you reduce the volume terms, certain non-trivial equations just disappear. They may just drop out. And so a good example here is, for example, in plane wave spacetimes. If you take a metric that has plane wave symmetry, you shove it into the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian, Gary knows what you'll get. You get zero. And because of this, you have no Lagrangian. But the most general metric with plane wave symmetry is not Ricci flat. So you have a field equation that's sitting waiting to be imposed, but you have no Lagrangian to impose it with. So this is the other kind of thing that you might guess up front is going to go wrong when you try to reduce a Lagrangian. Okay. And the claim is that, first of all, these are the only two things that can go wrong, and that I can give you some fairly simple, if arcane-looking, criteria for guaranteeing that they won't go wrong. But I need some definitions, and I apologize for this. It looks very sort of boring technical definitions, but it's really not so bad once you get into the game a little bit. So one thing we'll need is this notion of relative Lie algebra cohomology, which sounds worse than it really is. And it's just some properties of the structure constants of a Lie algebra. Geometrically, it's the space of closed forms on the Lie group that are invariant under this subgroup H, modulo exact forms, which are also invariant under this subgroup. So this is this H-invariant cohomology of the group. Okay, it's something you can compute by messing with the structure constants. There are computer programs to compute it. It's no big deal. I need some vector spaces. Okay. And the vector spaces are, to begin with, we'll fix a point in space-time, any point, pick one. Look at the space of symmetric rank 2 tensors there. These are the space of values that a metric could take at that point, essentially. Now look at the subspace. It's a vector subspace that's invariant under this linear isotropy group. Okay. Remember, that's some subgroup of the orthogonal group. So you're looking at tensors invariant under subgroup of the orthogonal group. Now look at the dual space to this vector space, and look at the subspace of, again, LG invariant tensors. Okay. And finally, we need one more vector space. Take this out of the dual space of this vector space, take the so-called annihilator of Q sub X. This is the set of linear functions on the original vector space which annihilate this space, okay, which map it to zero, take value zero on that subspace. All those things are a little bit boring to define, but they're very easy to compute. They're very, just trivial. You can, again, write computer programs if you like to just compute them. It's sort of a representation theory game. Okay. So here's the theorem. This Lagrangian reduction will work if and only if this cohomology is non-trivial at degree Q. Well, this was the orbit dimension. Okay. This is the isotropy group at the point X. And this has to be true for all x in the region in which you want this Lagrangian to reduce properly. Okay, that's one thing you need. Okay, this takes care of the boundary terms to make sure that the boundary terms reduce properly. And in particular, it guarantees you an appropriate invariant volume term on the orbits, which is what you use to reduce these boundary terms properly. The other condition you need, which takes care of the volume terms, is that the intersection of these two vector spaces, this was the space of, roughly speaking, invariant rank 2 tensors. This is the annihilator of that space. And this is these two spaces can't have anything in common. This takes care of the volume terms. And if this condition is not satisfied, it implies in particular that there's an invariant null vector sitting in your space. And so this is something that can only happen, at least for purely metric theories, when you have a null vector floating around that's invariant under the symmetry group. Is basically what happens here. So this is kind of interesting. This sort of obstruction to reduction of Lagrange will never happen in Riemannian theories. And one can make other statements about other signatures, but for Lorentzian signature, you need to have an invariant null vector for this thing to happen.
So yeah. The way that you said it really was that one way, that is to say, if one holds, then you don't have a problem with boundary terms.
Yes.
Two holds,
yes.
But you're only there.
Yes, yes, and that's the hard part. So it's enough to this will grant me these, and I'll easily show you that these difficulties won't arise. And now the only if, of course, is the hard part. And in fact, one has to now get a little more technical if you want to say exactly in what sense it's only if, because clearly, if I have the zero Lagrangian, then I never have any problems with reduction, and the field equations work because there are no field equations. So you need to basically this sort of these two are sufficient sufficient for this reduction of Lagrangians to work, but they're also necessary if you demand that the reduction works for any choice of Lagrangian.
Yeah.
And now you have, then I have to get into the trenches and we have to decide what, how big that space of Lagrangian should be. Okay, but we can formalize that using jet spaces and so forth. So this is, if you ask this to be true, that reduction works for a large enough class of Lagrangians, and these conditions become necessary.
So I may have some, you know, crazy theory, but some theory that does not be arriving.
Right.
In which case, your criteria violated, but just my Lagrangian.
Right. So the sort of the ultimate limit of quantum zero dynamics for the Lagrangian is zero, right? And that one will work. That's a pretty crazy theory, but sure. You just be, so. In fact, I have this comment here that this is meant to be giving you some criterion which this Lagrangian reduction will hold, irrespective of which Lagrangian you pick. You may happen to get these conditions failing for a specific Lagrangian and happen to get lucky. Okay, but that's something you just have to check. But if you want some a priori conditions that aren't too sensitive to you know, adding a few matter fields to your theory or something, then this is the sort of conditions you might like to have.
Well,
yes?
We know that you don't want to get involved in infinite dimensions, but how does Pallais analysis differ?
That's a great question. And Pallais also has this quite nice set of papers on this so-called symmetric criticality principle, which is a sort of another version of this same sort of issue. And he sort of considers functions or functionals or finite dimensional or infinite dimensional spaces all in one fell swoop. So if he was thinking about metrics with symmetry, he would think about the infinite dimensional space of metrics with symmetry as a manifold and then consider group actions there. Here I'm taking strong advantage of the fact that this is a local theory, and that, in particular, you have a Lagrangian. Whereas Pallais would consider, he wouldn't care if you have a Lagrangian or not. Any functional on the space will do as long as it has appropriate smoothness properties and so forth, and has some variance properties. He could consider whether you can get critical points of this functional by imposing symmetries and so forth. So there's a sort of an infinite dimensional version of all this, but this is which is sort of non-local in its presentation. And here we're taking strong advantage of the fact that it's actually we're considering local field theories with local Lagrangians. That's really the difference. So this, in some sense, is a local Lagrangian interpretation of some of the results of Pallais, I think is a one way to think about it.
But you still have to do some functional analysis, maybe the reason.
Yes, because absolutely. So in some sense, you might say, the problem is we haven't been able to prove these things quite rigorously, but these things we've proven, but I mean the relation to Pallais. But somehow it's like this, Pallais has some nice theorem, and then we'll say, you know, corollary, if there's exists a local Lagrangian, then this condition is equivalent to these two conditions. And I think that's the kind of thing you could prove, but we haven't been able to do it yet. Okay. Let me just mention that now you're in a position to go through the whole list of symmetry groups that Petrov is outlined, and you can just go and check, and you can just write a computer program, and you can have it just go through the groups and compute those conditions, because they're not hard to compute. They look a little arcane, but they're not hard to check. And you can go ahead and once and for all decide what symmetry reductions are kosher and which ones aren't, from the point of view of reducing Lagrangians. Okay? A harder question is to ask, suppose that the Lagrangians don't reduce, like what happens in Bianchi class B, for example. That doesn't mean that the reduced system doesn't admit a Lagrangian. It just means that you can't get it starting with the original Lagrangian. And so it's an interesting but much harder question to ask, under what conditions will you get a theory down below which still admits a Lagrangian of some type. And there are certainly examples where you reduce theories using homogeneous groups like Bianchi class B, and you get some, your starting Lagrangian doesn't reduce, but nevertheless the reduced theory admits a Lagrangian. So that can happen, and I don't know if anybody's investigated this for the Bianchi cosmologies, but maybe you could even answer this in some great degree of generality, I'm not sure. It's a harder problem.
At the level of the synthetic structure, which is not the same question you're asking, because to begin with, there is no synthetic structure either, because we don't have a but at the level of synthetic structure, you could come up with a synthetic structure.
You could.
Which gives you the right...
Right.
So, then
right.
It's not a very deep result, but not true.
Yeah, but actually... The existence of some plexic structure is, in some sense, the main obstruction to defining these Lagrangians.
Right.
So. You have to show me this. I think I know what work you're talking about, but maybe a reference.
There is that whole business of symplectic reduction that Marsden
yes.
and all those guys do.
Yes. This is not that.
Yeah.
Not at all. So they're in some sense characterizing the general solutions of the equations, whereas I'm sort of characterizing very restricted solutions that have a large degree of or a certain degree of symmetry, and that's not.
So nobody has really done that computer program.
No, it's something that should be done. I think. It would be a good project for a student, in fact, to somehow just run this thing. One can also make comments about reduction of conservation laws. Let me just say that you can reduce conservation laws in the same way, provided this Lie algebra cohomology condition holds. And I'll leave a sort of an exercise for you to think about why that would be true, and just the hint is think about Noether's theorem and reduction of Lagrangians a little bit. I think I'll just go to my last topic, which is sort of amusing and sort of motivated by work of Gary Horowitz. And this is what I'll call universal symmetries. So there's this phenomenon that happens that you bump up against when you start thinking about symmetry reduction in field theory. You start looking at lots of different field theories and looking at lots of different symmetry reductions and various solutions and so forth. And you come upon this phenomenon that sometimes you can get one non-trivial field configuration which solves many, many field equations. Okay. And this sort of phenomenon happens in Yang-Mills theory. It happens in sigma model, well, in harmonic mappings theory, if you think of that as sort of a kind of a sigma model. Yeah. So. Well, I'll give you an example in a minute, but you can. So, I need to define all field equations in a minute. Okay. But you certainly, one certainly, and so it needs to be defined. And I just want to give you some introductory flavor of the idea that you can. I know Gary knows what I'm talking about, but so you can imagine adding nonlinear modification or nonlinear. Yeah, but so the idea was it was a non-trivial field of configuration, and there. And there'll be an example in GR, and it's not just flat space time. Some people tell me these things happen in elasticity theory. So roughly speaking, no matter what Lagrangian you write down, for example, and what field equations you produce for that same kind of field, there's one solution of one equation solves them all. And what I want to point out is that this phenomenon sometimes oftentimes can be understood using a symmetry idea, and it's sort of a particularly potent kind of symmetry that not so strong as to make the field configuration trivial, like demanding that you have the Poincaré group of symmetries acting on space-time, but strong enough to sort of make all the field equations trivial in some sense. Let me give you one example real quickly from Riemannian geometry, and then give you an example from GR. Okay, so. This is the Riemannian geometry example due to Bleecker. The setting is compact Riemannian manifolds. And we'll consider a symmetry group now that's so-called isotropy irreducible. That is to say, it's a symmetry group, a group of isometries of this manifold, such that the linear isotropy group, which we've talked about from time to time, acts irreducibly on the tangent space. So it's a mapping of the vector space, and it can act irreducibly, no invariant subspaces. A simple example are spheres. You just think of round spheres and think about the rotation group that acts on them, and you look at what the isotropy group does at a point, and it just rotates everything around, and no vector is left invariant at a point by that transformation. But there are other more interesting spaces, more exotic spaces with this isotropy irreducible symmetry, and they're all completely computed by this fellow Wolf. Pretty famous set of results there. Now, that's the symmetry ingredient. That's the potent symmetry, if you will. Now I've got to tell you what I mean by all field equations, okay, to answer your question. And in this context, in this example, I'll consider any functional of the metric, any whatsoever. It doesn't have to be local, built from a local Lagrangian, just any functional. That is differentiable, so I can take its functional derivative. That is diffeomorphism invariant. That is to say, if I change this metric by a pullback by a diffeomorphism, this function doesn't see it. Okay, and it's also scale invariant, which didn't come out very well with my fat pen, but this just means if I multiply the metric by a constant, the function can't tell. Okay, then you can show that these isotropy irreducible metrics satisfy all field equations you could get from such functionals by functional differentiation. So these are always critical points of these functionals. Okay, and there was several ways to understand it, and it's not so hard to see that if you have this isotropy irreducible structure, then these field equations are satisfied. What Bleecker did, which was kind of a little harder, I think, was to show that if you demand that with these properties a metric be critical for all possible functionals of this form, then it must be one of these isotropy irreducible spaces. Okay, so that's an example from geometry, which maybe is familiar to some of you. Here's the example from GR, which I keep invoking Gary's name when I think about it. So this
didn't write down the metrics for the first time.
So this was motivated by a remark of Gary, a nice paper or two by Gary and Alan Steiff, and who noticed that plane-fronted gravitational waves are, in some sense, exact solutions of perturbative string theory. Is that still a fair statement? Yeah. Okay. And I was thinking about these things in this context of sort of one field configuration fits all equations kind of idea, and came up with a slight twist on this result. It's similar to this result, but a slight twist. I changed the starting assumption slightly. Okay. Instead of considering all plane-fronted waves, I consider just plane waves. Okay. This is a subset of the plane-fronted waves, but they have a fair amount of symmetry. And these plane waves show up as sort of counterexamples to lots of intuition in symmetry reduction theory. This is the nice place, for example, to show that these volume terms go bad when you reduce Lagrangian. And there are various other pathologies that can occur that are nicely illustrated using these plane waves. Okay, you're in four dimensions. You've got a five-dimensional group that has three-dimensional null orbits, and that means that the isotropy group is two-dimensional, which means the linear isotropy group is two-dimensional because they're isomorphic, as I pointed out. And in particular, it'll be a pair of null rotations fixing a common null vector. So this is a subgroup of the Lorentz group. This more or less completely characterizes what I mean by plane wave symmetry in four dimensions, and you can easily generalize everything I'm going to say to n dimensions, but we'll think about four dimensions for obvious reasons. So I have some five-dimensional symmetry group. This five-dimensional group is moving you on three along hypersurfaces R3, which are null, okay. But because it's a five-dimensional group moving three-dimensional surface, clearly at each point, two of these vectors generating the group have to be linearly dependent, and so you have a little two-dimensional isotropy. Oh, do you want to know what the abstract group is or what the group transformations are? Or it depends on sort of how you want to present it, but you could think of probably the simplest way is to think of it as three translations, and then at each point, a pair of null rotations. Okay, that's probably the easiest way, but to present it that way is sort of very local. There's a nicer global presentation of it, I think. Okay, so that's the symmetry we'll impose, and that's we'll just assume the metric has that symmetry. Okay, there's an infinite dimensional set of metrics with that symmetry. Okay. By the way, there's many, many plane wave symmetry groups. You pick a wave profile for your plane wave, there will be a symmetry group. You pick another plane wave profile, you get another symmetry group. So there's, roughly speaking, as many plane wave symmetry groups as there are plane waves. In other words, the plane wave transformation group depends on the wave profile that you give the metric. In any case, how about the field equations? So I want to try to be, we can be very general. We can, in some sense, really use all field equations in the following sense. I'll consider field equations which are setting to zero some symmetric rank 2 tensor field, which is built from the metric and its derivatives to arbitrary order, and all I care about is that this is some smooth function of the components of the metric and derivatives of the metric and so forth in any smooth chart you write down. So it doesn't have to be polynomial or analytic or anything. Just any smooth functions will do. And I'll also demand that the field equations be generally covariant in the sense that if you form the field equations from the metric, perform a diffeomorphism, that is the same as first performing a diffeomorphism on the metric, then forming the field equations.
Okay?
This is all, well, in this case, I think I need everything. This is all global. Okay? This is all global. This looks local, but you can just make the statement in any chart, and then with this sort of condition in place.
Can I have a non-local function?
No. So this, the number of derivatives has to terminate somewhere, but I don't care how high. Okay, I don't care about polynomial equations or analytic equations, but certainly smooth I need. Probably I can even make it not even fully smooth if I really worked. Okay, so here's the final result. So I'm just about done. I know my time is up. If you pick any metric with this plane wave symmetry, it will solve every field equation of the type I just described, except the Einstein equation. Okay? This is kind of amusing. Okay? What that means is you build any generally covariant expression you want, and you can get pretty creative if you want in using functions that are smooth and not analytic and so forth. And you'll find every one of these symmetric tensors has to vanish except the Ricci tensor and, of course, the metric itself. So
higher powers have been lost in traction for the
moment. That's the main reason. And whether you can use that argument to justify more general kinds of equations, which are just smooth functions of the derivative, I'm not sure. Well, the idea is that, in fact, everything is sort of null. So whenever you start making contraction, you get zero. And you can prove lots of other things about quantities you can build here. But so if you do impose the Einstein equations on your metric with plane wave symmetry, then, of course, now you've solved all field equations. And so you have what might be called a universal solution of the equations. And the proof is... So a proof that it works really nicely for sort of polynomial or even analytic kinds of field equations is really just a special case of what Gary and Alan did. But if you want to just sort of be a little more generic about the whole thing and just make those two basic assumptions on the field equations, then what you use is the fact that every metric with plane wave symmetry has a continuous self-similar, is continuously self-similar, has a homothetic symmetry. And then so they have a scaling symmetry in the problem. And then you can use some scaling behavior of generally covariant tensor fields that was first, I guess, noted by Gilkey a long time ago. And there's sort of a mismatch between the scaling symmetry and the scaling behavior of these equations, except in the Einstein tensor case. So the only one that can survive is the Einstein tensor. And just mention then, one perhaps would like to see if one could have seen this coming. In other words, how did the symmetry group get so powerful? How do you know up front when you're going to have one solution fitting many equations? And that, again, is something I think one can say something about in some generality. One thing that would be nice is to know how many types of solutions are there, like, this, say, in general relativity. So, I think I'll stop here. Thanks.
Other questions?
You had this Bessel was 60 or so.
Yeah.
Now, if I consider asymptotic Laplace spaces, then we know that the atomic group is a subgroup of these respective groups. That's very trivial.
If this as a global, the global isometry group.
Yeah, I mean, my question really is that so now we can just list all the subgroups of these three groups to begin with. My question was, does that make up the 60, or is that...
No. Petrov's classification has to be bigger, because he doesn't make any assumptions. I mean, he's working locally at all times, so...
So, I agree. I mean, logically, it doesn't have to be, but do we know that it is the case? I mean, there are lots of subgroups of Poincaré groups.
There certainly are.
I list them all. I might well get 60. I'm not surprised. I'm always surprised if I get 60.
That's the first answer. And the second answer is that, of course, there are many, many more groups that Petrov considers, but then one's able to turn one into the other by various diffeomorphisms and things. And I'm not sure how you would think about that from the point of view of...
No, but here's a list of groups. Okay, do all these groups appear? There are two lists of groups, one coming from the subgroups of Poincaré and the city and the city.
I'd have to think about it. My first reaction is there's no way these things do
that. The number of subgroups are surprised, a large number of subgroups.
Oh, no, even just the, I mean, if just number of subgroups of the Lorentz group is large. Yeah, quite large. But one can cut those down to some finite, very small number by assuming that you only consider conjugacy classes. For example, 14 conjugacy classes of the algebras of the Lorentz group, like that.
One, this work of Ward and other people where they'll take self-dual Yang-Mills and look at various symmetry reductions, and they seem to come up with almost any integrable system.
Yes.
Does this fit in with your scheme of algebra?
It could, and this is certainly a good observation, and it's something on our list of things to do.
It's rather amazing that you're having a KDV.
Yeah, sometimes there's some non-local changes of variables and things that are going on, and those are a little harder to treat systematically. The technology seems to be a little tough for those kind of things, to give very general sort of understandings of these things. So it's not clear to me yet, to the extent that they use non-local sorts of changes of variables and things, I'm not so sure. And there's some gauge fixing issues that always come into play and so forth. But yeah, so in principle we can address some of these things, but we haven't done so.
Anything else? Okay, thanks.